Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey there, Herman and Corin. So one of our dear listeners, well, actually, he's not a listener yet, but he will be. He suffered a cardiovascular event lately. And you may not know this, but I'm a very superstitious person. And I did not want to record this prompt to generate this episode until he had successfully underwent his surgery. And now that he did, I may wish him a recovery. We are very strict about how could a podcast where we so frequently discuss privacy and encryption not itself be somewhat cloaked in daggers? But so we will not divulge the name of this dear listener. We'll call him Mr. M. But we wish Mr. M a very, very speedy recovery. So Mr. M underwent open heart surgery. He had, I believe, a walking cardiac event. And I have a couple of questions. So I don't know much about this world, needless to say, but it sounds incredibly scary. When I was looking at what they do on YouTube, I watched a YouTube video of this procedure, and they like literally stop someone's heart. Like, that is insane. And a machine takes over. So I have a couple of questions, Herman and Corin, my usual fashion. I'll throw in one serious one and one kind of one that maybe only me would ask. First thing is this: how does that work? How advanced is this technology? Is it new? Like, how do you safely stop a human heart and bring it back online? Because we've talked about in the very capricious world, by comparison, of doing this with networks, right? Failover. This is the ultimate failover. We're failing over from a human heart to a artificial heart, and then we're failing back. So how does that work? I think Mr. M actually did work in networking, so I'm not sure he'd appreciate it being talked about in the with reference to the IP stack, but you know, maybe he will. Second question is this: when you think of a high stakes job, it doesn't really get more high stakes than being a cardiac surgeon. And what I always wondered is this, right? So at the moment, as we covered in a recent episode, I'm not sleeping the best because I'm going through somewhat of a unfortunate housing situation, and it's very stressful. Now, if you ask me, could I do heart surgery in the morning? I would say, well, I watched a YouTube video. Is that enough? And they'd say, after they kicked me out, they'd say, well, you look a bit haggard. I'd say, I am haggard. So my question is this: certain industries where you have very high stakes things, I know, for example, in the airline industry, which I often refer to as a gold standard for safety and procedure done so well. And regarding alcohol, I know they have a bottle to throttle rule. They're incredibly strict for good reason. But beyond that, what happens if your average, you know, heart surgeon just has a lousy night's sleep, or they wake up with allergies? Like, do they have to just say, I'm not feeling like I have to exempt myself? And the second thing I have to ask, I've had one surgery, it didn't go very well. Gallbladder surgery. We'll talk about the sorry state of my digestive system another time again. But that was, you know, laparoscopic surgery, right? Relatively routine. Open heart surgery and open brain surgery, these are the big, this is kind of as high stakes as it gets. And my question is, the people doing these operations, they're supremely qualified. No one's going to doubt that, right? To be put in this job. But they're also humans, and they also have to operate with at this level of pressure day in, day out. And I always just wonder how these guys do that. I was very surprised. My conception of surgery has always been sterility. It's a white room with big medical lights. And when I watched a video of a surgery before my gallbladder thing, it just made it less scary for me. I noticed that the surgeons were playing music, which I gather is pretty common. And that kind of humanized it for me, made it seem a bit less, you know, whatever helps them focus. And as I mentioned, as someone with ADHD, I can 100% emphasize with whatever hacks you have. I have my own hacks to keep focus. So those are my questions for imminent core and open heart surgery. How does it work? How does that happen? And for the amazing people that, do this kind of work, how do they perform, I mean, beyond their game for such a high stakes task day in, day out? I'm always eager to learn from the pros in whatever context that may be. Herman and Corin, over to you.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Corin, and I have to say, today's episode feels a bit more personal than usual. We have been thinking a lot about our friend and housemate Daniel lately, especially because he is the one who sent us the prompt for today's discussion.
Herman Poppleberry here. And yeah, Corin, Daniel's prompt comes from a very real place. He wanted to talk about open heart surgery because a listener he knows, who we will call Mr. M, recently had to go through it. Daniel was actually telling me the other night that he did not want to even record the prompt until he knew Mr. M was out of surgery and recovering.
It is a heavy topic, but Daniel's questions are so insightful. He is asking about the sheer mechanics of how we stop a human heart and bring it back online. It is essentially the ultimate failover, like in networking, except the stakes are a human life. And then there is the human side of it. How do surgeons perform at that level day after day, especially when they are tired or feeling under the weather?
It is a fascinating intersection of high-end engineering, biological limits, and extreme human performance. When you look at the history of cardiac surgery, we have moved from a place where the heart was considered a forbidden zone to a place where we can literally take it out of the loop for hours.
So, let's start with the big one. How do you actually stop a heart safely? I mean, we are taught from birth that if your heart stops, that is it. That is the end of the line. But in an operating room, it is a controlled pause. How does that work?
It starts with something called cardiopulmonary bypass. Most people know it as the heart-lung machine. Essentially, you are plumbing the patient into an external circuit. You insert large tubes, or cannulas, into the right atrium or the vena cava to take the deoxygenated blood out before it even gets to the heart. That blood goes into the machine, gets oxygenated, has the carbon dioxide scrubbed out, and then a pump pushes it back into the aorta to feed the rest of the body.
Okay, so the machine is doing the work of the heart and the lungs, but the heart is still sitting there, potentially still beating, and it is full of blood. That does not seem like an ideal environment for a surgeon to be sewing tiny grafts onto arteries that are the size of a strand of spaghetti.
Exactly. You need a bloodless, motionless field. To get that, you use a process called cardioplegia. This is where the chemistry gets really cool. The most common way to stop the heart is by using a solution that is very high in potassium. In a normal heartbeat, potassium and sodium ions moving across the cell membranes of the heart muscle are what trigger the contraction. By flooding the heart with a high concentration of potassium, you essentially lock those membranes in a state of depolarization. The electrical signals stop and the muscle just relaxes.
And you're also cooling the heart down, right? I have read that hypothermia plays a big role in protecting the tissue while it is stopped.
Absolutely. We call it myocardial protection. When you cool the heart down to maybe 15 or 20 degrees Celsius, you drastically lower its metabolic demand. It is like putting a computer into a deep sleep mode where it is barely drawing any power. This buys the surgeon time. Without that cooling and the cardioplegic solution, the heart tissue would start to die within minutes because it is not getting its own blood supply through the coronary arteries while the aorta is clamped.
It is well to think about the trust involved there. You are essentially letting someone turn off your most vital organ and hoping the chemistry and the pumps all work perfectly. What about the tech itself? Daniel asked how advanced it is. Are we still using the same basic pumps from the 1970s, or has it moved on?
Oh, it has moved on significantly. We are seeing a massive shift right now, especially here in early 26, toward what people are calling intelligent perfusion. For decades, the heart-lung machine was mostly a manual affair. You had a perfusionist, a highly trained specialist, who was constantly turning knobs and watching gauges to balance the blood flow, the oxygen levels, and the pressure.
Right. I remember we touched on some of the automation trends in episode 262 when we talked about semantic computing. Is that hitting the operating room too?
It is. We are starting to see AI-enhanced cardiopulmonary bypass systems. These are not replacing the perfusionist, but they are acting like a superpowered co-pilot. They can analyze over 50 different physiological parameters in real time. We are talking about things like oxygen delivery markers and metabolic demand. In recent clinical trials, some of these AI-driven systems have shown a 30% reduction in postoperative complications like acute kidney injury, which can happen if the blood flow from the machine is not perfectly dialed in.
That is a huge leap. But there was another thing that caught my eye recently. Earlier this month, there was a report about a major breakthrough at Emory University and the National Institutes of Health. Did you see that one?
Yes, that is the VECTOR procedure. It stands for ventriculocoronary transcatheter, outward navigation, and reentry. This is honestly mind-blowing because it challenges the very definition of open-heart surgery.
For those who missed it, the researchers performed what they are calling the world's first totally transcatheter bypass. Normally, even the least invasive bypass involves some kind of incision in the chest, even if it is just between the ribs. But with VECTOR, they went in through a catheter in the leg, worked their way up to the heart, and used a wire to navigate from the aorta into a clogged artery, to essentially build a new route for the blood from the inside out.
It is incredible. They did it for a 67-year-old man who was considered too high risk for traditional open-heart surgery, and 6 months later, he is doing great. It uses advanced imaging technology that allows the surgeon to see exactly where they are inside the vessel with incredible depth.
It makes me wonder if open-heart surgery, in the way we think of it with the cracked ribs and the big scar, is going to become a historical curiosity. But even with these new techniques, you still have the human element. Daniel asked about the pressure on the surgeons. How do they stay at the top of their game? What happens if they did not sleep well?
This is where the medical field is having a very serious, and sometimes difficult, conversation. For a long time, there was this Iron Man culture in surgery. You were expected to work 36 hours straight, grab a coffee, and go perform a triple bypass. But the data is finally catching up with the bravado.
I remember a study, I think it was back in the mid-2000s, that showed that being awake for 24 hours straight produced cognitive impairments similar to being legally intoxicated. If we would not let a surgeon operate while drunk, why do we let them operate while that's sleep-deprived?
Exactly. And the research specifically looking at surgeons is very telling. Research has confirmed that technical dexterity actually holds up surprisingly well under moderate sleep deprivation. You can still sew the stitch. But where you fall apart is what we call non-technical skills. Your situational awareness drops. Your communication with the team gets worse. Your ability to recognize a small problem before it becomes a catastrophe starts to tank.
So, it is the decision-making and the teamwork that go first. That is almost more dangerous in a heart surgery than a shaky hand, because the heart-lung machine is a team effort. If the surgeon is grumpy and stops listening to the perfusionist, that is when things go sideways.
Precisely. And Daniel asked if they have to exempt themselves, if they feel unwell. In 26, we are seeing more hospitals adopt what they call fitness for duty evaluations. It is not quite a mandatory no-fly rule like pilots have yet, but it is moving in that direction. Some of the top-tier cardiac centers now have backup on-call rosters specifically designed so that if a lead surgeon wakes up with a fever or had a family emergency that kept them up all night, they can step out without the professional stigma that used to exist.
It is about changing the culture from heroics to reliability. It reminds me of the aviation parallels Daniel mentioned. The surgical safety checklist is the most famous example of that.
And it is a direct descendant of aviation. Most people don't realize that the first formal pre-flight checklist came about because of a crash in 1935. It was the Boeing Model 299, the prototype for what became the B-17 Flying Fortress. It was the most advanced plane in the world, and on its big demonstration flight for the Army, it stalled and crashed right after takeoff.
And the crazy thing was, there was nothing wrong with the plane.
Nothing at all. The pilot, who was one of the Army's best, had simply forgotten to release the gust locks, the clamps that keep the tail flaps from flapping in the wind while it is parked. The plane was just too complex for one human brain to remember every single step every single time. So, the pilots created a simple cardboard checklist.
And that is exactly what Atul Gawande popularized in medicine with the World Health Organization Surgical Safety Checklist. It is not about teaching the surgeon how to do surgery. It is about making sure we have the right patient, the right site, and that everyone in the room knows each other's names and what the plan is if there is a massive bleed.
It sounds so basic, but when hospitals implemented that checklist, the rate of major complications and deaths dropped by more than a third in some studies. It is about offloading the easy stuff from your brain so you can focus all your cognitive energy on the hard stuff.
Speaking of focus, Daniel also mentioned music. He saw a video where surgeons were playing music in the operating room and wondered if that helps or hurts. I have always found it interesting that some surgeons want total silence, while others want heavy metal or classical.
It is a very debated topic. Research has found that for most surgeons, music they enjoy, played at a low to medium volume, actually improves their performance. It lowers their stress levels and helps them enter a flow state. It can actually make them faster and more accurate.
But there is a catch, right?
There is. The Say research found that if the music is too loud or if it has a very high erratic beat, it can interfere with communication. In an operating room, you are listening for the beep of the monitors, the sound of the suction, and the verbal cues from your team. If Master of Puppets is blasting at 11, you might miss the anesthesiologist saying the blood pressure is dropping.
I love the idea of dosing music like a drug. You use it to stay in the zone during the routine parts of the surgery, but when things get intense or you hit a critical juncture, you might turn it down or off entirely to reclaim that auditory bandwidth.
Exactly. It is all about managing the cognitive load. Surgery is an endurance sport. A complex heart case can go for 6, 8, even 12 hours. You cannot maintain peak red line focus for that entire time. You have to find ways to oscillate your energy.
It makes me think about the psychological toll on these people. To do this job, you have to have a certain level of confidence, maybe even a bit of an ego, to believe you can stop a heart and fix it. But you also need the humility to follow a checklist and admit when you are too tired to operate.
That balance is the real tech of the 21st century surgeon. We have the AI, we have the robots, we have the advanced catheter techniques, but the limiting factor is still the human mind. I think what Daniel's prompt highlights is that we are finally starting to treat surgeons as high-performance athletes or pilots rather than just doctors who are supposed to be invincible.
I agree. And I think for people like Mr. M, it is actually more comforting to know that your surgeon is using a checklist and listening to a Mozart concerto to stay calm, rather than just powering through on 3 hours of sleep and sheer willpower.
Definitely. It is a more robust system. And honestly, the advancements we are seeing just in the last month with things like advanced transcatheter procedures showed that the field is moving faster than ever. We are getting to a point where we can fix the most complex organ in the body with less and less trauma to the patient.
It is an incredible time for medicine. I hope Mr. M's recovery is going smoothly. It is a long road after open heart surgery, even with the best tech in the world.
It is. The heart is a resilient muscle, but it needs time to heal after you have been messing with its chemistry and its plumbing.
Well, I think we have covered a lot of ground here, from the potassium-rich solutions that stop the heart to the AI co-pilots helping the perfusionists. It is a perfect example of what we love to do on this show, taking a deep dive into the weird mechanics of things we usually take for granted.
And if you out there are enjoying these deep dives, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on your podcast app or over on Spotify. It genuinely helps more people find the show and keeps us going.
Yeah, it really does make a difference. We love hearing from you, and we love that you are as curious about these rabbit holes as we are. You can find all our past episodes, including the ones we mentioned today about semantic computing and the telemetry trap, at our website, myweirdprompts.com. We also have a contact form there if you want to send us a prompt like Daniel did.
This has been My Weird Probs. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you in the next one.
Stay curious, everyone.
And stay healthy. See you later.
All right. I am going to go check on Daniel and see if he wants to grab some dinner. I think he is finally breathing a sigh of relief now that the surgery is over.
Good idea. I will join you. I think we have earned a break after all that talk of potassium and bypass pumps.
See ya.
Tottle.
Wait, one more thing. I was thinking about that ex vivo lung perfusion tech we mentioned. The idea that we can keep an organ alive outside the body for days while we treat it or wait for a transplant, that is a whole other episode.
Oh, don't get me started. We could talk for an hour just about the ethics of that, let alone the engineering.
Next time, Herman. next time.
Deal.
Okay, now we are really going. Thanks for listening to My Weird Prompts. We are on Spotify and at myweirdprompts.com. Catch you soon.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Fading out. Did you know they are actually using ex vivo systems for hearts now, too? It is called Heart in a Box.
Fading out. Of course you knew that, Herman Poppleberry. Of course you did.
It is fascinating. They keep it warm and beating instead of cold and still.
We're going to dinner, Herman. Come on.
Fine, fine. But we are talking about it over hummus.
Deal.
Silence.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.